From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. And President Obama is in Ethiopia today. He's the first sitting president to visit that country.
And this is the last leg of his African tour. He has been talking about a lot of issues of importance to Africa and the United States. But he's made his first comments today about the Republicans who are trying to replace him. We're going to hear about that in a moment. But first, let's get to Washington and what's turning into a rare, busy summer week on Capitol Hill with transportation and the Export-Import Bank on the agenda. NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving is with us. And Ron, let's start with the Export-Import Bank, and let's start with a reminder of what it is and what is going on after this rare Sunday session in the Senate yesterday.
The Export-Import Bank is a special function of the federal government that makes loans to companies and countries outside the United States that want to buy goods and services from the United States. So it's a trade enhancement program. And it's been controversial in some circles because many conservatives feel it picks winners and losers in business, and they think the government should not be in that.
And it is run out of funding basically last month, right? So now
That's
they're trying
right.
to figure out what to do next.
June 30th, their charter expired, and so the Export-Import Bank at the moment is just administering the loans it has made in the past. It can't make any new ones, and a lot of companies in the United States and the U.S. Chamber of Commerce are quite upset about that and lobbying furiously to try to get it back.
So what happens now?
At this point, it is part of the Senate bill. The Senate came up with 62 votes in an unusual, really truly rare Sunday afternoon session. They came up with 62 votes to attach a renewal of the Ex-Im Bank charter to the currently under consideration Highway Trust Fund extension. So that's a piece of legislation that really everybody wants to see get done in one way or another, and that's running out this week on Friday. That's the deadline. Otherwise, a lot of roadway projects, a lot of bridge rebuilding projects around the country will literally have to shut down. So that's considered a must-pass.
Okay. And in the midst of this debate over transportation funding and the Export-Import Bank, there was some language that has caught some attention from a Republican Senator Ted Cruz of Texas, who is running for president, by the way, who called out the Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell about his plans with the Export-Import Bank. Here he is.
I cannot believe he would tell a flat-out lie. And I voted based on those assurances that he made to each and every one of us. What we just saw today was an absolute demonstration that not only what he told every Republican senator, but what he told the press over and over and over again was a simple lie.
Ron, what is he talking about there?
He's talking about a conversation that took place several weeks ago when the Senate was considering the trade enabling legislation that the president wanted, a negotiating thing called fast-track authority for the president. And there was a big conversation in a private meeting, a luncheon of all the Republican senators, 54 senators together. And Cruz kept peppering Mitch McConnell with the question, have you made some sort of deal with the Democrats that if they'll vote for this trade authority for the president, which they have questions about, you will give them a separate vote on the Export-Import Bank on must-pass legislation like the highway bill. And according to Cruz, Mitch McConnell said, no, there is no deal. There is no deal. And now, of course, in Cruz's mind, that's exactly what happened this weekend.
Okay. Well, meanwhile, as all of this is going on, and as you say, they're working to try to get this transportation bill through by the end of the week, President Obama in Ethiopia made his first comments about some of the Republicans hoping to replace him. Let's listen.
You know, the particular comments of Mr. Huckabee are, I think, part of just a general pattern that we've seen that is would be considered ridiculous if it weren't so sad.
Ron, remind us what Huckabee said and what President Obama's talking about there and what you think of Obama weighing in on the race, at least a little bit.
Former governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee, who is also a Baptist minister, said that if we went ahead with this Iran deal, we would be marching the Israelis to the door of the oven. So he was making a reference, of course, to the Holocaust. It is hard to imagine where some of the rhetoric on the Iran deal is going to go in September when Congress really gets down to formal consideration of the deal, when it's already so over the top. Ted Cruz again said the president of the United States would be becoming himself a leading state sponsor of terrorism. It's pretty hot right now, and the president felt he just had to respond.
And really never a good idea to compare anything to the Holocaust. NPR senior political editor and correspondent Ron Elving, thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Congress is working to pass this highway bill by a Friday deadline, and you can bet states are watching that fight very closely. The National Transportation Research Group, known as TRIP, recently found that 28% of roads across the country are in poor condition. In a handful of states, it's even worse. And that brings us to New Jersey. Nick Vitello is a senior research engineer at the Pavement Resource Program at the Center for Advanced Infrastructure and Transportation at Rutgers University. Nick, welcome to Here and Now.
Thank you.
And according to this new report, New Jersey is one of four states where at least 40% of the roads are in poor condition, which means there was probably a pretty good chance that you hit a pothole on your way into work today.
Oh, actually, at this time of the year, New Jersey has fixed most of those potholes. So the roads are in fairly good shape, considering the last two winters that we've had, where there was an incredible amount of potholes on the road.
Well, that sounds like good news, but give us the broader picture then. When you talk about the poor condition of New Jersey roads generally, just give us a picture. What are they like?
Okay. You have to realize that New Jersey has a very densely populated infrastructure. So we have a lot of roads and a lot of people traveling those roads. One of our biggest problems is just congestion, getting from one place to another. New Jersey's roads makes it difficult to do all the repairs because there are so many people on the roads at the time when you're trying to do the work. That forces us to do a lot of the state work during the night, when the amount of people is greatly reduced.
Mm. Can you zoom in now on one road in New Jersey that you just see as the absolute worst?
When I think of some of the worst roads we have, I think of Route 130. It's from down in South Jersey all the way up to New Brunswick. It's an old concrete roadway, and most of it's been covered with asphalt, so it makes it a composite roadway. And it's just because of its age and the amount of traffic that travels on it, it's old and it's can only be fixed a piece at a time.
When you step back and take a look at the debate that's happening in Congress over the funding for the highway transportation bill, how much of the road conditions in New Jersey have to do with Congress's failure to make a long-term solution here?
Well, I think it's compounded. There's the transportation bill that's being done at the federal level, and also New Jersey's own transportation trust fund. Without stable funding from either the U.S. DOT or the New Jersey's transportation trust fund, it's hard to plan what roads need to be repaired and when they need to be repaired. Mm. That's the biggest problem.
You mentioned that it's a dual funding stream here. You've got the federal DOT on one hand, and you've got the State Department on the other. What's happening on the New Jersey side? I understand the state has been considering possibly raising a gas tax. Is that a good solution in this situation?
Well, there has to be some other source of fund. The New Jersey's Transportation Trust Fund was established in 1984 to be a stable source of funding for either capital construction or maintenance of the roadways. And it worked very well in the beginning, but due to lack of funding and the increase in funding necessary to maintain these roadways and build new roadways and bridges, they had to put out bonds. And right now, paying back the bonds is actually using up the majority of the trust fund's money that comes in annually. So there's less and less money to do the actual work and more money needed just to pay back the bonds.
Mm. So what's the solution then for New Jersey?
I think a lot of the transportation folks in New Jersey would like to see the gas tax raised. New Jersey is the second lowest in the country. Alaska is actually the lowest at 12.4 cents per gallon. New Jersey is at 14.5 cents per gallon. Compared to the surrounding states, Pennsylvania is at 50 cents a gallon. Connecticut's 43 cents a gallon. So you can see that even though all of those entities exist very close to New Jersey, we still have the lowest of the gas tax.
Mm. You're a pavement guy, an engineer, I gather. Is there a technology solution here?
We continue to try to meet ever-increasing needs by improving the materials we used on our roads, and we've changed the way we preserve the pavements, use pavement preservation techniques. to try to stretch the taxpayer dollars.
But it doesn't sound like it's working.
Well, it's really just beginning. The payment preservation techniques being used by New Jersey DOT are relatively new to the state. In the past, we've done payment rehabilitation where we've waited till the pavement has reached a certain point in its life and done some major rehabilitations to that pavement. With pavement preservation techniques, we're able to address the needs of that pavement much earlier in its life at a much reduced cost.
Professor Nick Vitello is a senior research engineer at the Center for Advanced Infrastructure and Transportation at Rutgers in New Jersey. Professor, thanks very much for being with us.
No problem. Thank you.
In Montana, crews are fighting fire with fire, using explosives on Sunday to build a line around a wildfire burning inside Glacier National Park. Near San Diego, authorities say more than 400 firefighters are making progress containing a wildfire on the Cleveland National Forest. Officials say they expect it to be contained by Wednesday. But this fire season may be worst in Alaska, where hundreds of wildfires have blackened nearly 5 million acres. NPR's Nathan Rott is recently back from Alaska, where he's been reporting on this, and he joins us now. Nathan, welcome.
Thank you.
So 5 million acres, I really can't even get my head around what that means or what it looks like. Put it into context.
Yeah, I mean, it's a ton of land. It's an area roughly the same size as Massachusetts that's been burning or burnt in about 300 separate fires across Alaska's interior.
Wow.
That number of fires and acreage is unprecedented for this time of year in that state. Though it's important to say that it's not the biggest fire year ever yet, or at least not yet. In 2004, something like 6.6 million acres burned. So we're still a ways off from hitting that mark, but it's still crazy when you try to think about the time period in which all of that land burned.
Well, it is, and it makes you think, how did it get that bad?
Well, most of the fires that are burning now started around a month ago. There was this unbelievable lightning burst across interior Alaska in late June. Literally tens of thousands of lightning strikes after a few weeks where temperatures were near record highs and the air was really dry. People that I talked to in Alaska, people who had fought or been involved with fire for decades, say they'd never seen anything like it. Hillary Shook is the manager of the dispatch center there, and she said that when it all started, she called her mentor in, an older dispatcher, to help.
I was sitting in my office and he came in and he said, "That look of shock on your face is totally appropriate for the situation." And I was like, "Okay, I'm going to be okay. Tom's okay, I'm okay." So, yeah, I'm still a little wide-eyed.
Well, Nathan, when you hear that, I wonder if it's so shocking that there aren't even enough firefighters to put these fires out.
Well, the initial attack resources in the state of Alaska, the first responders, so to speak, they were completely tapped out within days. They didn't have enough people, enough helicopters, any of it. I asked the manager of the Alaska Fire Service in Fairbanks, Kent Slaughter, why that was.
With the amount that we got in that really short time period, any part of the country probably would have been overwhelmed.
I mean, essentially, there were so many fires burning there across such a wide area that the fire bosses had to start picking which fires to fight and which fires just to let burn.
Wow. So that can be kind of controversial, at least in the lower 48 states. I'm from Arizona, and the reporting that I've done there on wildfires, it's always that they're very aggressively fighting fires because there's always a structure in the way. So is there a different kind of attitude there in Alaska?
Oh, yeah, completely. I mean, fire is completely different in Alaska. We're talking about a geographic area that's a fifth of the size of the entire lower 48 in Alaska speak, the U.S. that we typically think of. So if you think about it, there's all of these areas and there's nobody there. And in that situation, fire managers there think they should have a good opportunity to just let fires do its natural thing, which is good in a lot of ways for a lot of forests. Clearly, that's not always the case. There are villages that are threatened, cabins and some highways. I even visited a fire that was threatening the Trans-Alaska Pipeline, which carries oil from the north end of the state to the south.
Yeah.
Those fires, they throw a lot of people at, even though it can be really, really, really hard to do. There are almost no roads, so air travel becomes a predominant thing, smoke jumpers and airdrops and things like that. But even that gets shut down when there's a lot of smoke in the air. Because of that, firefighters had to start taking boats up and down the Yukon and Tanana rivers just to get around.
Nathan, what do all these burning fires mean, though, for the landscape? To some extent, I guess fire is a natural thing, as you say, and it could be or should be encouraged. But when you've got that much burning, what does it mean for the ecology?
You know, yeah, it is a good and bad thing. Fire is just something that happens in wooded areas. And in Alaska, some of the native trees, the black spruce, they depend on it. It's also potentially really critical in the long term because there's heaps and heaps of permafrost in Alaska. And scientists say that there's about twice the amount of carbon in the world's permafrost as there is in the atmosphere. So that's a ton of carbon. And of course, carbon is the thing that helps lead to climate change.
And we're losing some of that permafrost already.
We are, yeah. But fire can really help to speed that up because what fire does is it burns through and it burns off the duff layer. And duff is just the stuff that falls from trees and sort of makes a carpet on the forest floor. That carpet acts as an insulating layer. When that burns away, all of a sudden that permafrost is exposed to the air. The air is warmer. You get more permafrost thaw, which releases more carbon, which creates more climate change, which could cause more fires. And, you know, you get the idea. It becomes a pretty dramatic cycle.
Yeah. Big changes in Alaska with these fires. NPR's Nathan Rott has been up in Alaska covering the wildfires in that state. Nathan, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
And it's not just fires threatening Alaska's wilderness. Reminders of the devastating earthquake and tsunami that struck Japan in 2011 are still washing ashore on Alaska's coast. This summer, crews are in the midst of a massive cleanup project, picking up and bagging tons of debris that were swept thousands of miles out to sea when the tsunami hit. Joining us now from Anchorage is Chris Pallister. He runs the Gulf of Alaska Keeper, the group behind the effort. And Chris, let's start with the scope of the problem. How bad is it?
The Gulf of Alaska coast has always had a lot of marine debris on it, but after the tsunami hit, the volume of debris has doubled since then. That translates into between, depending on which beaches you're on, between 10 and 20 tons of plastic per mile.
So take us to the beach then, in that sense. What does it look like on some of these coasts?
It looks like a linear landfill. I mean, it's just garbage as far as you can see, you know, walking down the shoreline. And it's some of these areas, the zone is pretty narrow because the beach is very steep and backed by cliffs. And there are other areas that debris scattered over, you know, 100, 200 yards deep into the forest and stuff.
And what kind of debris are we talking about? Marine debris all the way from Japan?
Yeah, so everything you can imagine in a house that floats. And plus, there's a tremendous amount of commercial fishing debris. A lot of that actually came from the tsunami because a lot of those coastal communities that got wiped out were heavily fishing-oriented, and they lost all of their aquaculture buoys and nets and all the floats they had on shore, boats and everything else.
And you can tell it's from Japan because there's Japanese script on it.
Yeah, a lot of it has Japanese script on it. A lot of it is things that, you know, you can tell that they were made in Japan. There are different styles to their, even their bottles are different. One thing we started finding a great deal of this year were property boundary stakes that are stuck on the corner of each property in Japan. They're a high-density plastic that took a couple years to get here.
Wow. So what's that like? Because I'm sure from your perspective, on the one hand, it's a nuisance because it's this plastic and trash building up on the Alaskan coast. But on the other hand, these are remnants of people's lives that these people might have died in the tsunami and the earthquake.
Yeah, especially poignant to me is when you find shoes. And these shoes we're finding are worn shoes. You know, they came out of somebody's closet or hallway or even off their feet. So when you start thinking about that, it's actually pretty disturbing. And we never forget for a moment that we're kind of mucking around in a graveyard out there.
Mm. So how does it work? How do you gather all this trash and dispose of it?
Well, this is an extremely rough shoreline, very remote. And so you basically get on there by foot most places. You know, we take boats to the shore, and then you're working on foot. There's no heavy equipment, and you're just removing all this stuff by hand, basically. And about the only power tools we use on the job are chainsaws to saw through drift logs and stuff so we can get a lot of the nets and lines out. Then we come back later and sling it off the shoreline with helicopters and put it on the barge.
And where's that trash go?
This load we're putting on the barge, we're shipping it down to Seattle, and we're going to have it recycled. A group called Parley for the Oceans from New York has taken over that portion of it for us, and they're going to sort it and take out what they can use for their recycling processes, and then the remainder will go to the landfill in Astoria, Oregon.
And this sounds a little bit like the tale of Sisyphus. I mean, you're pushing this boulder up a mountain, and as soon as you get there, it comes back down at you because the ocean probably just brings more trash to the coast. How realistic is it that you can actually make a dent in this problem?
Well, you know, that's a good question, because last week we were just out at Gore Point, very remote place on the Kenai Peninsula, and we clean that beach every year because we use it for one of our monitoring sites, and we just got done cleaning that beach, filled up 15 super sacks on just that one shoreline alone, and when we got all done, we were watching the waves roll in there on the beach, and you could see it, throughout the waves, you could see pieces of plastic coming up on the beach. You know, people always ask, why do it? More is just going to keep coming. Well, what's the alternative? We're just going to let it keep piling up until it's completely buried our beaches. Besides the fact that we have now cleaned over 1,500 miles of shoreline and rehabilitated a tremendous amount of habitat, it's recognition that's being brought to this problem by all the folks like us that are doing cleanup work. That probably is the biggest payoff in the long run, because this is a serious, serious environmental problem. I personally think it only ranks after global warming and ocean acidification as the big three, I call them, that are going to really harm the ocean. And I think the fact that people are working on it, bringing attention to it, is the most important thing.
Chris Pallister heads the Gulf of Alaska Keeper. He's in charge of a major project to clean trash off the coast of Alaska. Chris, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, no problem. I enjoyed it.
This is Here and Now from NPR and WBUR. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
Today, along with all of you, 49 returning Hall of Famers are in Cooperstown to welcome Craig Biggio, Randy Johnson, Pedro Martinez, and John Smoltz.
The annual Baseball Hall of Fame induction ceremony taking place yesterday. Here and Now's Alex Ashlock was there and says this year's class may be even more historic than most.
Baseball fans came from all over the country to see their favorite players enshrined in the Hall of Fame. Chad Pogue made the trip from Houston to watch Craig Biggio take his place among the greats of the game.
Love the Astros came out to support Biggio and our first Astro in the Hall of Fame. Our plane was full of Astro fans, and it's great to see all these Astro fans out here today.
Biggio played his entire 20-year career in Houston. He's the only player in baseball history with this combination of numbers. More than 3,000 hits, 600 doubles, 250 home runs, and 400 stolen bases.
I gave the game everything I had every day. In baseball, tomorrow is not guaranteed, and I tried to play every game as if it was going to be my last.
John Smoltz was perhaps the most versatile pitcher baseball has ever seen. He excelled as a starter and reliever, mostly for the Atlanta Braves. He's the only pitcher in baseball history with more than 200 wins and 150 saves. Smoltz's parents were in the audience yesterday, and during his acceptance speech, he told a story about telling them when he was 7 years old he wasn't going into the family business. He was going into baseball instead. His parents were accordion teachers.
You served as a great example for me and all future parents that when your kid has a dream, no matter how outrageous or outlandish it might be, giving them a chance to pursue that is the greatest thing in life. And you put aside what you thought would fall in the family line of tradition of great accordion players. I can't thank you enough.
In a crowd of thousands at 6'10" tall, Randy Johnson was hard to miss yesterday. He towered over his fellow inductees. He won 303 games in his 22-year career and struck out more than 4,800 batters. That's second on the all-time list behind Nolan Ryan. Since he left baseball, Johnson has concentrated on photography, which he studied at USC. In fact, he was taking pictures during yesterday's ceremony. But he's also been active supporting the USO.
In 6 years of retirement, I've been on seven USO tours: Iraq, Kuwait, Afghanistan, South Korea, Cuba. It means a lot for me to see our men and women doing what they do for all of us.
The Hall of Fame ceremony ended with Pedro Martinez. He had his best seasons for the Boston Red Sox. He won back-to-back Cy Young Awards in 1999 and 2000 as the best pitcher in the American League. Martinez grew up poor in the Dominican Republic. and his induction ceremony attracted hundreds of his countrymen and women. In his speech, which he delivered in English and Spanish, Martinez said he wanted to be a sign of hope for his native country.
It's a great moment, not only for me, for my family. It's a great moment for the Dominican Republic and Latin America.
Martinez brought that theme home at the end of his speech when he invited fellow Hall of Fame pitcher Juan Marichal to join him at the podium. Marichal is the only other player from the Dominican Republic in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Together, they held their nation's flag as the crowd stood and cheered. For Here and Now, I'm Alex Ashlock.
The New York Wage Board today formally endorsed a recommendation of a $15 minimum wage for fast food workers in the state, and the issue now heads to the state's labor commissioner to make a final decision. Governor Andrew Cuomo says he supports the proposal. Other cities, including Seattle and Los Angeles, have also moved towards raising their minimum wages for some or all workers to $15 an hour, and the issue now promises to be part of the 2016 presidential campaign. Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders over the weekend in Louisiana called for the federal minimum wage to be more than doubled.
So let's be clear. The federal minimum wage of $7.25 an hour is a starvation wage. It must be raised.
Joining us now to talk about the minimum wage and this push for a $15 minimum wage is Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
And what does it look like across the country? If you take a look at the map, is the minimum wage $15 just in a couple places and then mainly just at that $7.25, the federal wage? Or how do things look right now?
Sure. Let me set this up a bit. The context, I think, for this discussion is that the recovery has been adding jobs fairly steadily for the last few years. But we've really seen stagnating wage growth overall. And this follows decades of productivity outstripping wages. So you have a federal minimum wage of just $7.25, which is essentially the minimum wage of a lot of states. Basically, every state, if you sort of take a swath between Virginia down through Appalachia, through the Deep South. But the federal government's minimum wage doesn't apply to all workers because there's lots of states and lots of cities that set higher minimum wages. So just about every state on the West Coast and the Northeast, Florida, the minimum wage here is higher than the federal standard. So despite this context of slow wage growth and no action on the minimum wage at the federal level, we are seeing a local movement to raise the minimum wage, not only above where it is already on the coast, but in liberal cities right now, large cities, Seattle, San Francisco, Los Angeles, and now very recently New York City, we have a movement to raise the minimum wage fairly dramatically to $15.
Well, and of course, in those cities, the cost of living is different than they are in other places. And I asked the Dunkin' Donuts CEO last week, Nigel Travis, about the debate in New York City, which you could say is the most expensive place to live in the country, or at least one of the most expensive places to live in the country. It's where a lot of Dunkin' Donuts stores are. And here's what he said.
The movement to $15 by 2018 is actually a more aggressive rate than has been campaigned by many of the people who want to move it to $15. So I think the increase was too much too quickly.
So just to be clear, when do you think it would be a good idea to have a $15 minimum? Do you think 2018 is too soon to make that change at a big company like Dunkin' Donuts?
Well, I think the first thing I would say is it varies by state. If you actually look at cost of living by state, it is different. You know, we're in Massachusetts, so Massachusetts is going to be different from, say, Alabama.
Right.
So to answer your question, I think you firstly look at it on a state-by-state basis. I'm not clever enough to say what it should be in New York, but given that most of the campaigning has been for $15 by 2020, it seems 2018 is certainly too soon.
Now, Derek, we've been talking about the minimum wage, but the other language that's been creeping into this is people starting to call it a living wage. And what is the difference between a living wage and a minimum wage of $15, let's say?
Well, a minimum wage is a matter of law, and a living wage right now is a matter of rhetoric. A living wage is one of those terms that does not have a specific definition, but the upshot is that it's not right for people to work 35, 40 hours a week and remain below the poverty line. Their wage should afford them certain living standards, the ability to live in local housing, to buy food, to afford health care, the modern essentials. That's what we talk about when we talk about a living wage. But to Nigel Travis, Travis's point. He's right. You know, in New York City, a $15 minimum wage by 2018, 2020 might be reasonable. But, you know, in New York City, in the metro area of New York, the median household income is $60,000. In El Paso, it's $30,000. Wow. So it's a huge difference. And if you're going to have, if you're going to argue for a federal minimum wage of $15 for every city, whether the median household income is $15,000 or $70,000 like it is in San Francisco, that's where I think you begin to come up to the point where you've gone past where a lot of very reasonable economists have said people need to be able to afford a life in the city that they live, to get to the point where you're really asking for a wage that might be beyond the capacity for businesses in that area to hire all the people that they want.
And when it comes to the politics, we've certainly heard people on the left say the wage needs to go up to $15 an hour. We heard Bernie Sanders there at the top saying people should have a living wage. But a lot of Republicans have been against moving the wage up and moving it up certainly to $15 an hour. But we heard yesterday the former Bush speechwriter Matthew Dowd was on ABC's This Week, and here's what he said.
The base of the Republican Party are working class whites, and any increase in the minimum wage is going to help that group. So if I were a Republican candidate for president, I would get out there and say, yes, of course we need a living wage. That's what capitalism is about, and that's what we need to do.
Okay, so that's Matthew Dowd. This is the candidate, Jeb Bush, former Republican governor of Florida. Here he is talking about this issue just a few months back.
We need to leave it to the private sector. I think state minimum wages are fine. The federal government shouldn't be doing this. This is one of those poll-driven deals. It polls well, I'm sure. I haven't looked at the polling, but I'm sure on the surface, without any conversation, without any digging into it, people say, yeah, everybody's wages should be up.
Derek, talk about the Republican Party on this issue, because clearly as this becomes more of an issue, candidates are going to have to decide where they stand on raising the wage.
You know, I think that on the one hand, this is a political issue. Obviously, you know, Jeb Bush is running for president. He is interested in maintaining a conservative position on this issue, which is states' rights. Let's allow local communities to decide. But I also want to summarize what I think is a fairly complex and hard-fought economic debate about the minimum wage. So and whether or not raising the minimum wage is good for workers. So I think it's best to think of the minimum wage as a price for labor. And the way prices work in classical economics is the price goes up and demand goes down. So it's summer. Let's talk about lemonade. You know, you walk down the street, an adorable girl is selling lemonade for 10 cents. You prepare to give her that 10 cents. And by the time you fished out a dime from your pocket, she says, never mind, it's $2 per cup. And then you say no. Okay, you're willing to buy lemonade for 10 cents, but $2 is where you put away your wallet. So back to reality. There are jobs, some might say, where employers are willing to staff that job for $8 an hour, but not $15 an hour. That is where employers act like you did in front of that lemonade stand and put away the proverbial wallet. So there's this simple argument that says if we raise the minimum wage too high, it will remove a lot of lower paid jobs. On the other hand, I want to quickly say that the economy is obviously not just a bunch of lemonade stands. It's very complicated. And Walmart has found that by raising its wage, it's had less turnover. Less turnover means it doesn't have to spend as much time finding newer workers and burdening its human resources department. So this is a case where raising the minimum wage actually proved to be beneficial to the company economically. So I think that it's not just political. It's not just people saying things for polls. There is a fierce economic debate, not just about the effect of the minimum wage, but where exactly is the point where it becomes disemploying, where it becomes too high for businesses to hire all the way to full employment.
And we'll leave aside the fact that I haven't seen a lemonade stand in years.
as well.
I mean, maybe it's because I've been living in cities. They used to be everywhere, and now I never see these high-cost lemonade stands, right? But I wouldn't spend $2, I don't think, for lemonade. That seems outrageous, really. Derek, I want to invite our listeners to weigh in on this. You can shoot us a tweet at Jeremy Hobson, at DKTHOMP on Twitter, and let us know what you think about a $15 an hour minimum wage. Does that make sense where you live? Should it be by locale? Should it just be $15 in some of the big expensive cities and not in some of the more rural areas of this country? Let us know. You can also go to hereandnow.org. Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. Thank you so much, as always.
Thank you.
There's an emergency NATO meeting tomorrow to discuss Turkey's decision to expand its involvement in the fight against the self-proclaimed Islamic State. Turkey is now an active participant in the combat, conducting airstrikes against the extremists. But Kurds, who have also been fighting ISIS in both Iraq and Syria, say they are being targeted by Turkey. Kurdish separatists have a long-running territorial dispute with Turkey. Let's check in with the BBC's Mark Lowen. He's in Istanbul. And Mark, first of all, bring us up to speed on the moves Turkey has made in the last 24 hours. It's been a bit of a whirlwind.
An extraordinary few days, Peter, as Turkey has gone from reluctant observer in the fight against so-called Islamic State to being on the front line of military action against that group, but also taking action militarily against the PKK, the Kurdish separatists, for the first time in really in 4 years, certainly the first time since a ceasefire came into play with the PKK in 2013. And all the complications that that creates, because Turkey says it is dealing with a twin threat now, a double front line, if you like, from IS and the PKK, as tit-for-tat attacks between Turkish state apparatus and the PKK. So the last thing was an attack on a Turkish military convoy by the PKK that killed two Turkish soldiers and injured four. The PKK says that is in response to those airstrikes from Turkey on the PKK in northern Iraq. There have been allegations from Syrian Kurdish positions saying that the Turkish tanks have attacked them as well. It's all very, very messy now because, remember, the US-led coalition against IS is working with the Kurds on the ground. If Turkey pursues its fight against the Kurds, well, then that potentially complicates the situation hugely on the ground.
It is very complicated, as you say, and let's try and unravel it just a little bit more. What is this really about? I mean, is this a fight against ISIS, or is it a fight against this long-standing conflict Turkey has had with the Kurds? That's what seems hard to figure out from our perspective here.
Yeah, and it's the question that's being asked here as well in Turkey, Peter, because Turkey has had, of course, a 30-year conflict with the PKK, with the Kurds, that only ended recently. That killed 40,000 people. It has got a problem with the PKK, and critics say that it is only engaging in military action against IS now in order to use it as a cover for going after its real target, the Kurds. Turkey denies that. It says it will hit out at terrorist organizations wherever they are, and it has now summoned a meeting of NATO ambassadors in Brussels tomorrow, Tuesday, under Article 4 of the NATO Convention, the fifth time that that's been invoked, in order to raise the profile of this double threat. We've had, over the last couple of days, a series of phone calls to the Turkish Prime Minister from the German Chancellor, the British Prime Minister, the head of the EU foreign policy team, saying, look, you have the right, Turkey has the right to defend itself against terrorist threats, but try to do it in self in a proportionate way, and try to also return to the negotiating table with the PKK, because if Turkey slips back into armed conflict with the PKK, that hampers immeasurably its potential role in the fight against IS, and therefore jeopardizes the Western strategy against the jihadists.
How is this going over with the people there in Turkey? There have been protests over the weekend. There were protests last week as well after that suicide bombing near the Syrian border.
There's a real concern here about the specter of armed conflict returning. The wounds of the PKK conflict are still very raw here. As you say, there has been a series of protests over the last few days, peace rallies held, and also protests by the Kurds, by the Kurdish population, because Istanbul has a huge Kurdish population who have protested against the Turkish police, who have responded with tear gas and water cannons. So it's got rather messy. But at the rallies for peace, I mean, I've talked to people who say say, look, the Turkish government is trying to push us back into a civil conflict between the Turks and the Kurds, and we don't want that. You know, we've been through enough. So I think there is a lot of pressure on Turkey to pull back. There's a lot of pressure on the PKK to pull back. But when I spoke to a PKK spokesman a couple of days ago, he said to me that the ceasefire between the PKK and Turkey is in effect meaningless now, because in their view, Turkey has unilaterally ended it by the airstrikes on the PKK. What the Turkish government says is actually it is the PKK which ended the ceasefire by starting to shoot dead Turkish policemen last week. So it is really a kind of tit-for-tat retaliatory thing at the moment.
Is there a sense that Turkey now, today, is woken up at the edge of a dangerous crossroads?
Yes, very much. Turkey, the peace process with the PKK was an essential element in Turkey's democratization. It was an essential element in trying to keep this vital Western ally stable and in check. It is a hugely important thing for sort of stabilizing the Kurds in Syria and Iraq, who are working with the US-led coalition against Islamic State. So if all of that goes up in smoke, then that has huge consequences across the Middle East. And that is why there is so much pressure now for possibly a return to the peace process and ceasefire. But at the moment, it's sort of looking really as though that ceasefire could well be dead in the water.
The BBC's Mark Lowen tracking a volatile situation there from Istanbul. Mark, thanks very much.
Pleasure.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd. Robin Young is back tomorrow.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. I'm back tomorrow, too. This is Here and Now.